If you're asking me about, you know, if you want to go back to asking how many viruses do I have in my sample and what's the potential of risk, the viability PCR is at least 10 times more sensitive than any other assay we have on the market, whether it's the animal or the cell culture assay, just because it allows us to detect the nucleic acid, which we know from standard PCR, conventional PCR, can go down to single copy numbers or even 1/10 of a copy number you can actually detect. So sensitivity-wise, this is the most sensitive assay that you can run.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Mycotoxins were found in over 90% of feed sampled in 2025. Don't let mycotoxins impact your pig's health and performance. Visit dsm-firmenich.com/fumzyme. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. AB Vista, intelligent nutritional solutions to boost pig health and performance. Vaccinova, formulate to your needs, custom-made vaccines. Healthier pigs are good for producers, people, profits, and planet.
Hello and welcome back to the Swine It Podcast Show. My name is Daniel Linhares. I'll be your host today, where we're going to have Dr. Declan Schroeder. Hi, Declan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Daniel. Thanks for having me.
And now, well, Dr. Declan is a faculty member at the University of Minnesota, and his work has been grabbing so much attention from all of us in academia and also in the field with his work on viability PCR and some virus work. So we're going to talk more about that. But first, Declan, would you quickly introduce yourself here to the audience? So for those who might not be familiar with you and in your work.
No, sure, will do. So I'm a faculty full professor at the University of Minnesota, Department of Veterinary Population Medicine. And my title really here is Professor of Virology. And virology is essentially what I am most interested in, is viruses, all things about viruses, how viruses interact, how viruses have evolved, and how to describe viruses, right? So the key thing is it's a really difficult entity to work with, because it doesn't grow on its own. It requires hosts. And for me, finding tools to describe viruses, to characterize them, is really key, right? It's what I'm trying to meet them also where they're at. So a lot of my experience have been is on multiple species, from honeybees to algae to now pigs, dairy as well, because with influenza. And what I try and understand is trying to understand where viruses are at in the environment, for example, right? How do you study a virus where you don't really fully understand the host? And so the main tools of interest is really molecular virology, things like understanding the genome of the virus, understanding how you describe the genome. So techniques like sequencing I do. And the other option, of course, is PCR. PCR is one of the favorite tools as a molecular biologist. Mm-hmm. But PCR is diverse, right? I know you know how different uses of PCR we use in our industry. When I talk about our industry, the swine industry. And so there's lots of nuances there. And I do try and understand which version of PCR is the one will give us more information than normal.
Pigs are constantly threatened by the exposure of mycotoxins in their feed. Fumonisins are a highly prevalent mycotoxin that can impact health and performance. DSM Firmenich offers a range of analytical services, sampling to assess mycotoxin contamination, and solutions to combat mycotoxins. One of those solutions is Fumzyme, the only FDA-approved enzyme to deactivate fumonisins. Visit dsm-firmenich.com/fumzyme to learn more.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a fun background right there. Viruses, all species, and we've been able to follow your work more on swine side. To be honest with you, I don't keep up with the literature. But from the swine side, right, we've been working with this, what you call the viability PCR. And so can you expand a little bit more about what is a viability PCR, how does it differentiate from what we may know as the conventional PCR?
Right. No, yeah, absolutely. And that even the term viability can also conjure up different thoughts, right, in terms of what even concepts are with viability. So explaining it is very important. And that's a key thing about terms and names is that we always put a picture to what we think it is by just hearing the name for the first time. And it'll be surprised to hear that viability and viability PCR are actually not directly linked, which is actually quite funny if you think about it. So when people think about PCR, we know what PCR is. PCR is the detection of nucleic acids. And and so it can be any organism or any biological entity like a virus, what they all have in common is a nucleic acid base. So it can be DNA or RNA, right? So PCR is the detection of DNA or RNA. So viability PCR is now saying, well, can you detect this nucleic acid, this DNA, RNA in a viable form? And then that's essentially what viability PCR is trying to understand that viability piece. The problem is that when you look at the name, you think that means it's somehow related to live infections or infections or virus genomes that talks about disease. And it can and also cannot. It doesn't automatically mean that. So what to best explain viability PCR is to understand is how we get to running a viability PCR. And this is where I was saying there's actually a disconnect between PCR and viability, because it's got nothing to do with the PCR directly. It's got to do with the way you prepare the sample. So the secret sauce of viability PCR is the way you prepare the sample. Right, remember that. That's the really key. So what happens is in any sort of diagnostic setting or even in any experimental setting, you will grab a sample from the environment, you grab a sample from an animal, you grab a sample from a cell culture in the lab, any source of sample, right? And you then ask the question, how much virus do I have in there? And so you use a PCR as an example to detect that virus. Okay, there's other ways of doing it, but PCR is one of the common ways. And so when you do that, PCR will just tell you how much nucleic acids are in there. And it tells you everything, but it doesn't tell you the context. It doesn't tell you whether that nucleic acid, that genome is part of that virus or the functional virus. And so what the viability PCR does is actually what the viability step does is you take that sample and you treat it. And you treat it with chemistry. And there's different chemistries on the market now. There's not just one. And there's various chemistries that you can add to your sample. That what it does, it actually chemically links to any nucleic acid, any DNA or RNA that's not bound by a virus particle. And that's key. If a virus is intact, this chemistry will not bind to it. And so what it does, it actually subtracts as a subtraction event. It'll actually bind to all the free DNA or RNA in the sample. And by doing so, when you run the PCR, when you do the extraction and run the PCR, you are not detecting this free DNA or free RNA. So the secret sauce is in the way you prepare the sample before you do the PCR. So the PCR is a standard technique, which we all use, but if you prepare your sample properly, you can actually ask the question, is the signal from a viable sample preparation, or is it from just degraded? Because you can imagine, right, you can have a completely degraded virus. The DNA or the RNA is still available and the PCR will work. It doesn't tell you anything. So getting rid of the noise, getting rid of the background, you can really ask the question, is there any viable DNA or RNA in that sample? So is there any viable virus in that sample? I will end off with one more statement, Daniel. Just one other point I want to clarify is that that's only the starting point, right? That tells you, and like everything else in this world, you've got to do additional steps to actually ask the question, what is the viability? What's that assay actually telling you? And what the assay is telling you is that the virus always needs a host to replicate. The virus needs to move on, right? And so the term viability in this context is not that this is a live virus. All it's saying is it's equivalent to like a seed. It tells you that I have a seed now. My sample is telling me I've removed all the noise. I have a viable fraction. I can tell you that I know that the virus is, in this case, a form of a virus particle. It's a seed. What I need to do is I need to plant the seed. So at some point, you need to do additional experiments to ask the question, does this seed actually germinate to produce a plant? And so the viability PCR, at least what it does, it takes away the noise. It asks if there is a seed available, a virus particle. The flip side is, if you have no viable virus in that sample, if you go from, say, a million viruses now to 100 viruses or zero, it means that why do you need to do an infection study? Because there is no virus particle. There is no seeds. I've just removed all the seeds. I've taken all the seeds out of your bag and you plant nothing. So the viability PCR also has this potential power. If you remove something by doing some treatment and you reduce the amount of viruses in that sample, you've actually made it non-infectious, right? Because you don't have virus particles left. So that is a long-winded explanation of viability PCR. It's the ability to remove the noise and ask really interesting questions about your sample. Do I have viable virus in my sample?
I see. So if I understand correctly, when we say viability PCR is a two-step process. First, we got to start with the right sample. Then we can talk more about how do we prepare that sample. But if you have the right sample, the first step is it's a PCR to detect if there is viral DNA or RNA in the sample. And if there is, then the second stage is you have a combination of, you said, secret sauce or chemicals to determine if those RNA, DNA, they are wrapped in a way that suggests that the virus is intact with the potential to establish potential of being infective, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to infect, but does it have the potential or not because it's intact as established by the second chemical analysis? Does that summarize what I...
Yeah, absolutely. And that first step, yeah, absolutely. And that first step is true because in the end, when you do viability PCR, you have to do both. You have to do the conventional PCR alongside the viability PCR because they both work hand in hand. That initial conventional PCR tells you everything, right? I can detect all the nucleic acids. It's almost like another term we use in molecular biology is called eDNA. It's like you don't even have to have the animal present. You can just ask, is the nucleic acid present, the DNA or RNA present, is it present? But the animal doesn't have to be present. And so there's the same principle in virology. A conventional PCR just tells you whether the virus is present or not in terms of its genome signal. But when you add the secret sauce, the chemistry for viability, and you compare conventional versus viability, you then realize the numbers are different. And so you can really understand what that sample is. And then you can run additional experiments.
And for those out in the field planning to, I'm going to send some samples. And for this assay, you said the samples got to be right. They got to be prepared. What are your instructions for people out in the field planning to send samples for that type of assay?
Right. So you got to make sure that the process of collecting and the process of transfer doesn't cause damage to the virus, right? Because you want to make sure that that sample has the virus in its right context. So if you prepare the sample and you send it just by normal courier without protection through either a chemistry, you add a chemistry to the sample for protection, or you do temperature. Temperatures are quite a good way of preserving a sample, freezing
on ice.
That then protects the integrity of the sample. So when the sample arrives to us in the lab, we can then add this chemistry, this second chemistry, which is the viability chemistry, because then it removes. So your sample processing is really, really important. That said, Daniel, absolutely, it's not ready yet. I'm running trials now, but I actually have another way of running this assay where we can actually give the people on the farm, give the people in the field, the chemistry that you can add very easily. And then when you send the sample, you can just send it by normal mail. And then the viability PCR can be run. So this is work in progress. Maybe next time we meet on a podcast, we can actually describe this new way of sending samples. But yeah, sample storage is very important.
Yeah, but for now, until we have that chemistry ready, it's for the message for the field is just submit samples like you're doing for virus isolation, for example, right? It's put them on ice or preserve as much as possible the integrity. Because if there is infective virus, then you don't want them to be hurt in the storage transport process.
Right. All right.
And then you hinted to some applications, right? And if I think about why would I use a viability PCR, I could think about trailer decontamination validation, or this podcast, by the way, is sponsored by DSM. So we could also, another application is effect of feed mitigants on pathogen reduction, right? You may have that question. So can you elaborate a little bit on the potential applications for this assay?
Right. I've had a lot of interest when it comes to biosecurity. Right. Biosecurity is where a lot of the concern is that if you have naive pigs or pigs that have been protected, but they in isolation, you want to keep it that way. And so you're trying to stop the virus from entering the system. So you gave two really good examples. One is trailers, right? When we move animals around, and if there's an infected animal on this trailer, and there's a number of studies that have shown that you go back and you screen surfaces in this trailer, you can still detect via PCR the signal of PRRS being present, or PD. Two examples, right, of a virus that are commonly still plaguing our industry. And so the question then asks is this the source of entry? Can it come through? And that's the same rationale when it comes to feed. You know, Scott D has done some interesting work and really important work, you know, pointing to the risk of feed being a way you then bring things onto the farm. And if a virus is present in the feed, how do you decontaminate that system? And again, you can do PCR on feed, and you can find a positive signal for PD or PRRS, example. So that's the idea. So again, now you're using PCR, and the PCR doesn't tell you whether that's just old virus that's destroyed. So the DNA or RNA is present, but the virus is long gone. It's dead, right? It's like an eDNA sample. So the viability gives you this additional information. The viability PCR, when you run alongside a normal conventional PCR, it actually asks the question, actually, is there intact virus particles there? And that's what the viable thing. Are there viable virus particles? And if the answer is yes, your interpretation of that regional PCR signal changes. That's the biggest power, is asking, is there a biosecurity threat because the virus particle is still intact?
And you talked about a chemistry, right? Both when talking about the viability aspect of the assay and the feed mitigants. So the PCR, the question is, are those chemistries and mechanisms of action compatible with each other? Can you still detect intact viruses if they were exposed by the feed mitigants in a feed sample, for example?
Right. Yeah. Let's use that as an example, because you can do the same thing with trailers, right? Trailers sometimes use detergents to clean a trailer, and so you remove it. But let's not go into that detail. Let's focus a little bit on feed, because feed is really a really interesting subject area, because feed has multiple components in them that has been added over the years to allow you to improve the health of an animal, right? So in the swine industry, we have so many supplements we add, and it's been largely focused on nutrition, and it's also been focused on, and some of them are shown to be antimicrobial. And the question is whether some of these things are antiviral. And And so to answer your first part of this question about, you know, do they interact with your chemistry for the viability PCR? Some of them do, and you actually have to be really careful. When you run your assays, you can't just apply it and assume it'll work. You have to do your tests in the lab. And actually, we spent now the best part of 5 years understanding the interaction and the sort of stability of that viability chemistry as it relates to these chemistries that we are trying to look at and address. And the good news, Daniel, is many of them still hold up. So what I mean by that is that they are compatible with the viability assay. You can actually run them together and the viability assay still works. There are some exceptions, mm-hmm. but largely speaking, and as is also said, there are different types of products, even that gets used for viability. A lot of there's different companies that can supply viability chemistry, and not all of them are equal. And so you've got to do your homework, and working with a lab who has this experience is very important. So that's the one aspect. Are they compatible with the viability chemistry? Yes, largely they are. And one actually interesting thing is that when you run these chemistries together side by side, you find really interesting relationships as to how the viability reacts to the sample itself, because it's not only the sample, it's actually like for example, in feed, the feed ingredient is important, right? So corn, for example, corn or soybeans actually interact differently with viruses than on their own, let alone the additional chemistries you add to it when it comes to viability PCR, that is.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. And what else have you learned about things like the feed matrix? You're talking about those different matrices, right? And moistures and storage conditions and how does that, what are the implications for those, for the success of this essay?
This is actually, for me, I'm going to start by stepping back a little bit by addressing that fundamental question about, you know, the sort of assays we used to run when it comes to efficacy testing. And we have in our industry the gold standard of using animal studies. And before that, we also use things like cell culture to look at efficacy of an ingredient. What the viability assay has done is allows us to actually get a little bit closer to mechanism. So what I mean by that is when you add a chemical mitigant, and there are various chemical mitigants, like, for example, DSM has example products that you can add to feed. And when you add them to feed, when you run your gold standard assays, you can see that the animal health improves. You can see that the animal is not negatively affected by the virus present, but you don't understand why. And a lot of these assays have always made the assumption that it's a nutritional piece, right? All of these chemistries have been added because it improves the health of the animal and makes the animal resilient to a virus infection. And what I found, which was interesting when running the viability PCRs, is that what we can do is we can separate the animal side of it, so what the animal response is, to what the virus is experiencing in the presence of these chemical mitigants. And actually, a lot of the chemistries that we've been looking at showed really good potential as antivirals. So like DSM as a product, that if you add this chemistry away from the animal and just put it directly in contact with the virus particle, we actually get log reduction. We get log reduction equivalent to some of the sterilization chemistries you have in the field. So there's been one really interesting observation that you have these compounds that we add as we thought as nutritional advantage, or we thought as a cellular coping response, actually in themselves have unnatural antivirals. And it shouldn't really be surprising because there's antimicrobial activity we've observed before, because you can do this with bacteria. Bacteria you can grow independently, and so you can see this, but the bacteria you can see growing. Viruses you can't grow independent of the animal. But now with the viability PCR, you can do this independent of the animal. Lots of compounds out there that have been shown now that we work on, everything from from medium chain fatty acids to essential oils, all these sort of compounds now we're seeing as being antivirals, and the viability PCR has really opened this up.
Yeah, great. Just remind everybody, so this is a SwineIt podcast. If you like this show, please like it, love it, share it, post it, repost it, whatever your platform allows. So going back here, Dr. Declan, this, you mentioned some other assays available, right? As a virologist, some other assays available to determine the infectivity of the virus. How does the viability PCR compare to virus isolation in terms of sensitivity, analytical sensitivity, right?
Right. So if you're asking me about, you know, if you want to go back to asking how many viruses do I have in my sample, and what's the potential of risk, the viability PCR is at least 10 times more sensitive than any other assay we have on the market, whether it's the animal or the cell culture assay, just because it allows us to detect the nucleic acid, which we know from standard PCR, conventional PCR, can go down to single copy numbers or even 1/10 of a copy number you can actually detect. So sensitivity-wise, this is the most sensitive assay that you can run if you're asking if this is viable. And we can do this because we titrate genomic copy numbers relative to things like TCID50 numbers or cell kill numbers. It's far more sensitive than any of those. And this is more important when it comes to when you try and interpret the data, right? When you ask the question, like, for example, chemical mitigants, right? If you're saying, oh, I see 2-log reduction, 3-log reduction, 4-log reduction, and you can actually confirm that I'm starting off with a certain virus load or dose. And that's what the beauty of PCR, because purely PCR is quantitative. So you can run standard curves and you can compare directly to copy numbers. When you do this, you can immediately look at log reduction. You can look at efficiency curves. You can look at stability. And if you can get read down to single copy, you can ask, is a single virus present in the sample? You get this very quickly with a viability PCR because it's that sensitive. It can detect a single virus.
And how does that compare to the gold standard, I would say, maybe it's not anymore, but you should refer to bioassay as the gold standard, because then the pig, or the biological system, right? If you're thinking about pigs, it will be pigs. Will tell if the virus is actually infecting or not. How does that compare to that in terms of sensitivity?
It's chalk and cheese. I mean, apples, oranges. You can't really compare, because the problem with the animal experiment, first of all, is too expensive. And because it's expensive, your animal number is limited. You can only do so many animals. And then if anyone has ever done these assays, and you've done this in the past, right, just where even the dose you give, your controls, if you don't give a dose high enough, and we even know like intramuscular injection is far more reproducible than intranasal, for example, if you know you need a certain titer, you need a certain load to get that positive to always be positive, and you see the infection in the animals, and we work doses greater than 10 to the 4. So you need 10,000 virus particles to see a proper infection and to have enough animals to see this. You know, this is the difference between an assay run something like that, where you need that high dose, to an animal to experiment where you can do in the lab, where you can work on tens of virus particles, 100 virus particles, and ask the question, can you see an infection take place? And in the end, what we're trying to do is we're trying to bypass all those barriers that you have in a natural system that reduces the chances of the virus to find the right receptor in the right tissue of an animal to cause and initiate an infection. And so this is the biggest problem with an animal type study. It doesn't mean you mustn't do it. In fact, in the end, you still need to do animal studies. There is no question about that. I'm just saying that if you can get to the mechanism as well, if you run these cellular assays first, and if you run this in vitro assay, like a PCR assay, together, it gives you confidence. right? I see no disease in an animal, but I back this up with a viability PCR that tells me my titer is now below detection. Together tells you you've solved the problem. If you don't have the viability PCR and you just do the animal study and you have a negative result, the worst thing in science is a negative result. I don't see disease, so it means I must be okay. And how many times have we shot ourselves in the foot where we say, okay, you're virus-free, keep going. The herd is negative, keep going, and then suddenly it goes positive. Did we miss something? Yes, we probably did.
Yeah. Well, that's so good. We're approaching the end here. A couple more questions I'd like to ask is, you reminded us that infectivity depends on the pathogen, on the host, on the route, on the dose, on many different things, right? And so for helping people out there in the field understand how can they use this is the viability PCR is, can they use that for any virus today or particular viruses that you guys have validated and worked and feel comfortable offering? How does that, can you talk about that spectrum of viruses that this is currently being available for?
Yeah, you can't use it on every virus just yet because the PCR needs to be tested relative to the chemistry, relative to the condition. So the good news so far, if ASF ever arrives, we've already developed it for ASF. We've developed it for PERS, for PED, Seneca Valley, influenza of all types. So I can do influenza humans, pigs, dairy, poultry, swine. And there's a few others that are currently being developed in my lab. So there's a good tranche of viruses that are of interest now to the swine industry that we have in our lab that's been fully validated with the chemistry, with the reliability. And if people are interested in a virus that I don't have, it's come talk to me. It doesn't take us that long because it's about understanding. So I have genomic data. We have to use the genomic data to design the right primer context, then to run the chemistry, and then we develop the final assay. So yeah, come talk to me and I'll can guide you through the development of any new ones. But the main candidates like influenza, PED, and PERS, we've got them ready to go.
And ASF, you mentioned that, right?
And ASF, hopefully, touch wood, it doesn't happen here, but you know, we got to be ready.
It's time for our famous three.
Well, as any good scientist, we like to remind people of the limitations of the assays right before somebody brings them to the table. So what are the limitations or cautions you want to remind people about when they are thinking about using a viability PCR?
Yeah, one of the key things is remember that especially when it comes to treatment, right? So when it comes to treatment and you're looking like chemical mitigation, right? As I said to you before, a negative result is always one of the worst results. So one of the negative results you can get with a viability PCR is that you see no loss in virus damage. So in other words, the virus structure is still maintained. And actually, an example of this is formalin or any sort of any aldehyde will do this. And we know that's a limitation of viability PCR because we know that the aldehydes work. So the mechanism of action of an aldehyde is to cross-link and fix things in place. So if you do a treatment and you run a viability PCR on, say, a formalin-preserved sample, the PCR is exactly the same as a conventional PCR. Why? Because you basically fixed the virus. So your chemical mitigant is not to destroy the virus, but it fixes it. And so when you do the viability PCR in that context, your conclusion is, oh, formalin doesn't work. Well, no, it did. It made the structure no longer infectious because it doesn't open up anymore, or the receptors have been modified. So one of the big limitations of viability PCR is that if you don't see log reduction, it doesn't mean that your chemical mitigant doesn't work. It just means you have to do still the infectivity assay because it says there's still structurally intact virus particles. You still need to do the assays. The good news, of course, is the opposite is true. If you then see massive log reduction, means there's no virus particles, means you are okay. So remember that the viability PCR is about the structure viability, is about saying the virus is still intact. It doesn't mean that the virus is not infectious. And as you alluded to as well, Daniel, with some of your questions early on, it's also about understanding compatibility of the various chemical mitigants you use with the viability PCR chemistry. If it doesn't work, it doesn't. You can't run the viability PCR. So there's also limitations as to what chemistries you can run with the assay.
So that will be available through, if people are interested, do they reach directly to you? Do they reach the Minnesota VDL? How does that work? And any indication of what's the price and turnaround time? Those will be frequently asked questions.
Right. At the moment, it's still largely experimental. So reach out to me. I can either do one-to-one service provision for experiments that you're interested in. The VDL at the moment, I'm currently working with Minnesota VDL to develop a platform that it can be available just on routine. So the first answer is you reach out to me. If you go to the Minnesota VDL, they'll put you back to me. I'm the one that's, my lab is currently running this because we have all the techniques available. We are hoping within the next 6 months to have this available through the VDL. As I said, we're running pilots at the moment where we are testing in-field application of the viability PCR so that the sample can be run. And then your turnaround time, Daniel, is exactly what you do now for normal PCR. You submit it and you can request same day or the next day return. So that's the ambition, that we wish to provide this as a routine service. If you come via me, it's project specific and your goal specific. We'll discuss and we can turn things around weeks or months, depending on your question.
Sounds good. All right. Well, that's all about what we had here prepared for today. Any closing comments here on the application or mechanisms or anything else you would like to? Oh, we should have talked about that before.
No, I just thank you for having this opportunity. I think it's always good to keep talking about viability PCR and what we really mean by it. Right. I cannot overemphasize the fact that it's an additional tool. There is no silver bullet in science, unfortunately. We think, oh, I have one experiment, I'll solve all the problems. Viability is an important tool in the catalog of all the tools we can use to make animals disease-free, right? And to protect them against disease, not necessarily always stopping an infection, but controlling the infection. And so, you know, my message is biosecurity is still number one. My message is embrace new tools. Be suspicious, understand why, come to the source. You know, I've been promoting this technique now for a few years. The importance is for me using podcasts like this to bring it, you know, to transfer the message to everyone to say it's a new tool. It's really has great potential. Understand how you can use it, and I think it will, while not being a silver bullet, it has the potential to give us so much more information than we've ever had before.
One more tool in the toolbox, and like you said, for specific questions, it could give very, very, very specific and important with field applicable outcomes for decision making out there. So thank you again for this, and for all of you listening, thanks for sticking to the end, and see you next time.
Cheers. Bye.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.